Hi, this is Pastor Warren from Beverly Hills Community Church, and this is the third in a series on Old Testament survey. We are just doing an overview, trying to give you a feel for what the Old Testament is really about. So our first message was kind of an introduction to why the whole Old Testament itself is important. Then the second message was about the first five books of the Old Testament, what we know as the Torah, or the Pentateuch, for five volumes. And then in this teaching today, I want to talk to you about what we call the historical books. Now, I explained this in the class there at church itself, but let me say it on this recording as well, that I like people to understand that Christians and Jews, of course, look at the Old Testament differently. We have the same books that they have, but we number them differently. For example, we have the same books that they have, but we put them in different order. And then also we categorize the books of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible differently. We Christians tend to say that there are four divisions of the Old Testament, and those would be the Torah, the first five books, and then what we're going to look at today, the historical books, then the wisdom and poetry books, which include Psalms and Proverbs and so on, and then the prophets. And so we say there are four categories. Or we can say there are five, actually, because we divide the prophets into major prophets and minor prophets. So if you do that, you have five divisions in the Christian scheme of things. Whereas Jewish people divide the Old Testament, the Tanakh, as it's called, into three categories. They have the Torah, which is the letter T, then the Nevi'im, which is the Hebrew word for prophets, so that's an N. And then they have the Ketuvim, which is the Hebrew word for writings. And in that category, they put Psalms, and they put even the book of Daniel and Esther and all sorts of books in that. And so they then put those three letters together, T, N, and K, and they put vowels in between, and they say it's the Tanakh. It's like an acrostic, and that's what they call the Old Testament, the Tanakh, or you'll see it called the Hebrew Bible. And they have those three categories, whereas we have four or five. Now, I want to start off this message on the historical books, as we call them. And by the way, the Jewish people call the historical books the former prophets because they view them as prophetic books, which are telling history indeed, but from a prophetic viewpoint. And a prophet would give you an interpretation of history. So you're going to see that in a minute in these scriptures I read. So the Jews call these books the former prophets, and then they call Isaiah and Jeremiah and all that the latter prophets. We call these books the historical books. Now, let me read these scriptures. The first one is in 2 Kings 17, and I'm going to read verses 6 through 23. Okay, so it says, in the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, and he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. By the way, the Medes are the forefathers of today's Kurds who helped us in the Iraq War. And this occurred, verse 7, because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel and in the customs that the kings of Israel had practiced. And the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they made offerings on all the high places as the nations did, whom the Lord carried away before them. And they did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger. And they served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this. Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your fathers and that I sent to you by my servants, the prophets, but they would not listen. And so then it goes on to say, and for this reason, verse 23, the Lord removed them, or removed Israel, out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. So you see, the Jews call this the former prophets because it's history, but it's written from a prophetic viewpoint. The prophet can look at history and interpret it. So the writer of this book is saying that these terrible things happened to Israel, the northern kingdom, as it were, because of their sins, their idolatry, and their failure to obey God's covenant. Now, I want to go to 2 Chronicles 36 and look at verse 11. It says, Zedekiah was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah, the prophet who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. All the officers of the priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of the Lord that he had made holy in Jerusalem. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, but they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, until there was no remedy. Therefore, he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king and the provinces. All these he brought to Babylon, and they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its precious vessels. He took into exile to Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths all the days that it lay desolate. It kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. Okay, so reading those long passages of scripture, I hope you could see right there what I'm talking about when I say the Jews call this the former prophets. Because you see, these were prophetic books. Kings was written at the end when and it's about how Israel fell and was taken into captivity by the Assyrians. Chronicles was written after it was all over and was telling how Judah fell to the Babylonians. But both of them had a prophetic outlook because both of them spoke about why these things happened to Israel. Why did they get defeated by enemies and carried away captive? Well, it was because of their sins and because they disobeyed the Lord and his covenant and didn't even listen when he sent them prophets to try to bring them back in line. So, that's why, you know, this section is very important. It's called, we Christians call it the historical books. But really what I'd like to have you notice is that the word history can easily be divided into two words, his story. And that is what we really need to know about history. It's actually his story. God is in charge of it. Here's how I introduce this section. I usually ask people, what do we learn from history? And I usually answer, the only thing we consistently learn from history is that human beings never really learn from history. At least the majority don't, right? Only wise people learn from history. They pay attention, they learn the lessons that history can teach. And so I hope we'll be wise as we look at these books and that we'll learn some things from them. Is there a message for us in these books? I believe there sure is. You better believe there is. And that message is simply that it's all his story. And I want to show you why I believe that. First of all, let's talk about what books are in what we Christians call the historical books. Let's do like a quick flyover. There are 12 books included in the historical section. First one's Joshua. Joshua, of course, comes right after what we just looked at last time, the Pentateuch. You have the five books of Moses. And then when Moses passed from the scene, he laid hands on Joshua and Joshua took over. And he led Israel into the promised land. So you have that story there of the transition from Moses, you know, who brought him out of Egypt and took him through 40 years in the wilderness and then passed the baton, so to speak, to Joshua, who led him into the promised land. And it's pretty interesting because Moses is called the lawgiver and he represents the Torah, the law of God. And the fact that he died and couldn't bring Israel into the promised land is actually sort of a typological prophecy, if you will. It's illustrative because we can never be made righteous and enter our inheritance from God through the law. And so the fact that Moses couldn't do it, even the great Moses couldn't lead them in, is very illustrative of something. And Joshua did. He did lead them into the promised land. And the name Joshua is actually the same as the name Jesus. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but Yehoshua is Joshua, and Yehoshua is really Jesus' name. We today say Yeshua, but it's really Jesus' name. So Joshua is like a type of Jesus. He leads us into our inheritance with God. He leads us into victory and into our inheritance, you know, our promised land, so to speak. And so Joshua is a book about warfare because they had to take possession of the promised land. And it's a story of people who, for the most part, obeyed God, except for one illustration there, one exception. There was a guy named Achan, and he disobeyed God and caused a lot of problems. He caused some 36 people to lose their lives, and he himself lost his life, and Israel was stopped in their progress, their advance into the promised land because of his sin. But for the most part, Joshua and all of his generation, they were faithful to God, and so God was faithful to them. He fulfilled all his promises to them. There's also another story, the story of the Gibeonites, which illustrates that even Joshua sometimes forgot to pray, and he sometimes failed to some extent. These Gibeonites, they deceived Joshua and told him that they came from far away when actually they lived near at hand. And so that caused a setback, and they didn't pray, and so they were deceived by these people. But even that, God was able to turn around and make it turn out all right for them, because for the most part, Joshua did what he was supposed to do, and so did his generation. But the book of Judges follows Joshua, and it's not such a positive story because it's really a story about a downward spiral into apostasy and chaos, because the people of the time of the Judges constantly would go astray from God and they failed to stay in relationship with God. And kind of the main quote from that whole section is this: everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's what you see repeated over and over in the book of Judges. And so you see these repetitive cycles of sin. What I mean by that is you see repetitively in the book of Judges, God would do something great for his people, but then that they would go astray from him. They wouldn't pay attention to his commandments anymore. They would mix with the heathen peoples of the land, and they would go astray into idolatry, worshiping other gods, and so forth. And when they did that, God would then allow their enemies to overwhelm them, to defeat them. He would bring judgment, and they would fall under the oppression of the surrounding peoples. Then the people would cry out to God. He'd deliver them again. But once he delivered them, they'd go right back to their sinful ways. So it's really a pitiful book where everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and it was just a downward spiral for years. Now, Ruth is a wonderful little story. It's kind of a bright spot in the midst of all that darkness of the book of Judges, because it happens at the same time as the book of Judges, but it fills in the background and genealogy of King David. And it also shows how God preserves and protects and blesses faithful people like Ruth, who was actually a Gentile, a Moabite. They were supposed to be excluded from God's people, but God makes exceptions when people the right sort of heart. And this woman did. And she took care of her mother-in-law, Ruth. And so God ended up taking care of them. He brought a person named Boaz, who was known as the Goel, or kinsman redeemer. And that's a biblical term, which it's important to learn about, because it's really a picture of Jesus. He's our kinsman redeemer. But in this little story, Boaz is like a picture of Jesus. And he spreads his garment over Ruth and says he's going to take care of her. And he ends up marrying her and taking care of her mother-in-law. And he's a rich man. And so it's really a picture of how we are just beggars, and we're poor, and we're desperate. And if we come to the Lord, he covers us and takes care of us. Now, 1 and 2 Samuel follow Ruth, and they were written by the prophet Samuel. They tell the story of the transition from the judges into the next kind of era of Israel, which was the era of the kings. And so the last judge was Samuel. He was a great judge of Israel. He was anointed by God, and he was a prophet as well as a judge. He spoke the word of the Lord to the people, and he tried to guide them to the Lord. And God used him to bridge the gap between judges and kings, because the people by that time were really asking for a king. They were seeing that these judges would come and go, and they kept making errors and going away from the Lord. And so they thought that a king would help them against their enemies and lead them to better times. And that's a whole story in itself. But anyway, God had Samuel anoint the first king that Israel ever had, who was a guy named Saul. And then, of course, Saul had to be replaced, and God anointed his successor, who was King David. And so 1 Samuel tells about Samuel and Saul, and 2 Samuel is more about David. Then we have the books of 1 and 2 Kings, which are the story of Israel under the monarchical rule from the time of David up through the division of the nation into two kingdoms. See, we'll see about that later, but Israel was divided into two kingdoms. You had the northern 10 tribes and then the southern two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, in the south, and they came to be called Judah. And so the northern tribes were called Israel, and they were also called Samaria at other times. And they sort of apostatized from God right soon after they separated from the southern tribes, and king led them into idolatry. And so they ended up being defeated by the Assyrians, who were the superpower of that region in that time. And that's one of the texts I read to you today. I read to you 2 Kings that tells about that. And they were defeated by the Assyrians and taken away into captivity, and they never returned in mass or as an official sort of return. They never came back. Of course, individuals did, but not the tribes per se. Judah was the southern kingdom. There, the sons of David continued as kings, reigning over that area for 450 years. But they also went astray from God, and most of the kings did not do what God wanted, and so they were carried into captivity by the Babylonians about 150 years after the northern tribes were taken away by the Assyrians. So both of these books tell the sad story of this repeated disobedience to the law of God, which eventually resulted in total defeat and exile of all the Israelites. And then we have 1 and 2 Chronicles, and some people think that they're the same as 1 and 2 Kings, but they're not. They were written later. They were written after Israel had been, Judah had been banished to Babylon and then came back and was allowed to return from captivity. So it's written at a later time, and it fills in some things that Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, do not tell us about. And they tell the story of Israel all the way from Adam, with the emphasis being on how Israel was blessed when they sought God and obeyed him, but how they were cursed and destroyed when they ignored or disobeyed him. So they're prophetic history, see? So it's telling you history, but with this prophetic angle, that this is what God says about the history and why they were punished and so forth. You see, you don't know that from a secular history. You might have conjecture about it, but when a prophetic person tells you by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, this is why this happened. See, that's, by the way, that's as an aside. Let me just point that out. it's dangerous to say, you know, we have coronavirus now because God is judging us, or that country was defeated in a war because God is angry at them. Did you know tornadoes destroy churches as well as topless bars? They do. So you got to be real careful about saying God is judging those people, or God sent us this sickness to judge us, or whatever. When a prophetic person, a person who is authorized by God to say so, says that something's a judgment, then you know that it really is. But other than that, we better be careful about that, because you can have very good people who get cancer or whatever, and that doesn't mean God is punishing them. So be careful about saying that. But in these prophetic history books of 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, it says it was the judgment of God, and that's why they were punished. Now, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are combined in the Jewish Bible as one book, but for us they're two books, and they both tell the story of the return from exile, how God restored Israel after they were banished to Babylon. And they also tell about his sort of supernatural oversight over the people while they were banished there. But they show how even when God had mercy on them and brought them back to the promised land, they still kept constantly sinning, and they were right on the verge of destruction. Esther is an amazing little book. Esther is has been made into more than one movie because, you know, it's really a very fascinating story about this beauty queen, this girl Esther. She gets chosen by the king of Persia, the most powerful empire on earth, because he has to get rid of his queen. She angers him and he dismisses her. And so then Esther is part of this sort of a collection of all the beautiful virgins in the whole kingdom for the king to, you know, pick the one he likes the most. And people call it a love story, and the movies usually make it a love story, but it's hardly a love story since the guy had like 1,000 women in his harem. Hardly love. But anyway, it is a nice, very beautiful story about, by the way, God's never even mentioned in the whole book, but God is obviously behind the scenes working, and it shows that, how he gets people into strategic positions to save his people, to influence the turn of events in history. And so it really shows the sovereignty of God. Now, let me switch gears here a bit and just give you a brief summary of the historical section, just some facts about it. These 12 books, first of all, I want you to know they cover a period of about 1,000 years of Israel's history, from about 1406 BC to 443 BC. Remember, BC time counts backwards. So 1406, something like that, to 443 BC. So it's about 1,000 years that these 12 books cover. So that's quite a lot of history. Remember, the New Testament is just a very short little segment of history. It covers, you know, 30 years or something, but the Old Testament covers a lot of history. And so this period of the historical books deals with Israel's entry into the promised land under Joshua, as I said, but then the life of Israel in the promised land under the judges, which took quite a few years, their transition to having a king and living under monarchical rule, and then the division of the nation into two kingdoms and the life that was lived in both of those kingdoms. And then it leads to the downfall and exile of each kingdom, life in exile, and Judah's return from exile. So that's kind of the biblical history of Israel. And I did a video on this on my website. I hope you'll listen to sometime. It tells you about the main events of Israelite history. I think it's important for Bible believers to understand, at least have an overview of the main events of Hebrew history. So these books, these historical books, they give a prophetic view of history. They show the direct connection between Israel's obedience or disobedience to God and the blessings or curses of the Old Covenant. You know, and God said through Moses at the end of the books of Moses in Deuteronomy, God told them that these things were going to happen, that if they disobeyed his covenant, he was going to banish them, and then if they cried out to him from exile, he would bring them back. So it was all predicted before it ever happened, and then it was all carried out just as God said it would happen. So again, the Jews call Joshua, Judges, the books of Samuel and Kings, the former prophets, even though they are historical, because of the prophetic perspective from which they are written. Now, there are so many messages in these books, I could never preach them all in my whole life. Let me just mention to you some of the subjects that are taught here. Did you know spiritual warfare is taught? A lot of people, that's a popular topic today. A lot of people want to know about spiritual warfare. Well, you really see it in these books, especially in Joshua and Nehemiah. You learn things about like the devil's strategies and how he tries to take us out and how he tries to deceive us and get us to be afraid and how he tries to distract us and how he tries to tempt us to compromise and so forth. So it's really a lot about spiritual warfare and about how important it is for us to obey the word, because that'll keep us on track and get us into our inheritance. But if we don't obey, how we'll be compromised and weakened. You also learn a lot in these books about faith and how God can use just a few people to change the world. Because like, you know, the story of Gideon, his 300 guys, you know, they conquered a much larger army because God was with them. And the different judges in the book of Judges, you know, guys like Samson, he would kill large numbers of people because God would empower him. And different judges, God would give them victory, even though they were outnumbered and outgunned. Because they were obeying God, he'd give them victory. So you see that, you know, even the story of Esther shows how one young girl could really influence history. And there's lots of that in these books. These books also show how compromise with the world can ruin our lives and our testimonies. Samson is another great example. I mean, the guy was anointed by God and given such incredible physical strength and stamina and so forth. But his wickedness, his adultery, his constant fornication opened him up to eventually be blinded and then destroyed. And then likewise with various other judges, their sins and the sins of the people, constantly they would fall away from God and it would bring their downfall. And so there's a lot of lessons about that in these books. How God calls people and leads them, you see a lot of that in the Bible. For example, he calls Samuel when he's a little boy. He speaks to him and says, Samuel, Samuel. And he runs to Eli, the priest, and says, here I am, you called me. And the priest says, I didn't call you. And, you know, he has to learn that God, it's God speaking into his spirit. You know, he's hearing God's voice, but he doesn't know that. And God also calls the first king, Saul, and he causes him to have all these signs that are worked out for him to confirm to him that God is leading him to be the king. And how God anoints David and so forth. Then the David is a tremendous example of all the trials that we believers go through. He's anointed of God. He's called of God. God loves him. And he's a man after God's own heart. But yet he goes through these incredible trials and difficulties. And he gets real discouraged at times. So we see that kind of thing. And there's the danger of listening to false prophets in these historical books. 1 Kings 13 is a terrific example of a prophet who actually was a man of God, but yet even he was deceived by another guy who said he was a prophet. And so you learn about the dangers of false prophets and how we can't just trust whoever says they're from God. The prayer of Jabez is in 1 Chronicles 4. That was a famous book. You know, tons of people bought that book. The sovereignty of God is demonstrated again and again in books like Ruth and Esther. You know, these humble women, and yet God is with them, and how God provides for them, takes care of them, and so forth. You know, Ruth being a widow, Esther being a young Jewish girl in this pagan land, you know, of Persia and so forth. The way in which God works among the nations using people that you wouldn't expect, you know. And like I say, Esther, Ruth, and also Ezra, Nehemiah, and other foreign nations, you know, God used them. So all these things, we could go on and on. There's tons of lessons in these books of the Bible. But what's kind of the main message? What would I say is kind of the main point of these books? Well, I would tremble to say, but let me just take a stab at it. I think that, first of all, one of the main messages is what I already said, that history is truly his story. You know, some people have the notion that history is just sort of cyclical. It just goes around and around and it's not leading anywhere. We just evolved here by accident and life is kind of swirling around meaninglessly. You know, we're going nowhere. There's no purpose whatsoever. None whatsoever. Well, these books refute that. They show us, oh no, history is his story. God launched history. God created everything. God put us here on the earth. He has set the parameters and the conditions of life. And what we experience in life is directly related to how we interact and relate with Him or fail to do so. All the heathen nations were made up of people who didn't know the Lord or obey the Lord, but they prospered or declined based on how they interacted with God's people and His plans. You come against God's people, and it's not going to go well for you. People who blessed Abraham's descendants were given favor and mercy. Look at Rahab, for example. She was a harlot, but she protected Israel's spies in the city of Jericho, and so God saved her and her family. Or look at Ruth. She was a Moabitess. They were supposed to be excluded from God's covenant, but she blessed her Israelite mother-in-law, and God took care of her. The people in these books were destroyed for their wickedness, as in the case of the Canaanite nations or any nation that came against Israel. And of course, Israel was also punished when they fell into wickedness. God's people were defeated when they were in sin, but they got the victory when they were following the Lord. And likewise, the wicked nations would defeat God's people when God's people were in sin, but they'd be defeated by God's people when God's people were doing what the Lord wanted them to do. So Israel, you know, they had all these ups and downs when they were obedient to God and His leader. Then they would have success, even against overwhelming odds. But when they ignored God's covenant, worshiped other gods, they let the temple or worship of God fall into disuse or disrepair, they were beaten, even by small groups. They were oppressed. They were diminished in every way, militarily, economically, spiritually, socially. And so God shows us by that in these books that He is the center and the source of our lives. We're not here to live as we might want or do whatever we might please. We're here to live for God. We're here to seek God. That's what our lives are supposed to be about. We need to orient our lives around Him and His purposes and His commandments, because it's all His story. If you want to get a clear message from these books, it's this. Look, nobody ignores God and prospers. Not long term anyway. You might get away with something for even years, but sooner or later you're going to give account to God and judgment will fall. The New Testament puts it this way in Galatians 6, 7, and 8. It says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." And that's a lesson of these historical books. They're teaching us what happens if you obey God and what happens if you don't obey God. And so it's all His story. Now, I'd say another primary message is that God will always ultimately win. I think that's important to recognize. These books teach that. God always wins. Some people think, you know, God's kind of wringing His hands, man. You know, He just wishes people would obey Him, but nobody listens. Adam and Eve, they were deceived and He lost them, and He brought the Israelites out of Egypt, but in no time they complained. I mean, they made a golden calf, and so God had to punish them. He got them in the promised land, but then they were backslidden, and everybody always fails God. Nobody ever listens. They wanted a king, even though He was their king. He gave them one, but then that guy went astray, you know. And so some people think God is just kind of wringing His hands. But these books teach us that that's not the case at all. Rather, the true nature of the situation is God knew exactly what was going to happen. He told His people what would happen beforehand, long before they did it. Like in places like Deuteronomy 4, 23 through 31, or Deuteronomy 31, 29, God told His people, even through Moses, long before all this happened, exactly what they were going to do. He wasn't taken by surprise by it. He knew what was going to happen. But He allows us to go whichever way we want to go. That's why He says in Deuteronomy 31, "I set before you death and cursing, or life and blessing. Please choose life." And that's still a message for us today. We choose if we want to walk with God or not. God won't force you. He's not going to send an angel to stop you from sinning. You can sin if you want to, but if you do, these books teach you what happens. Because I believe another of the main messages from the history books is that God is sovereign. In other words, He's always in control. In the end, He always wins. He always accomplishes what He set out to do. He always fulfills His promises. Now, He's grieved by man's sin, don't get me wrong, but He's not thwarted by it at all. During the days of Samuel, the priest that he lived was raised by was Eli, right? And Eli's sons were priests too, but they were wicked. And so, you know, here's the ministers of God, and they're wicked. Well, you might say, oh man, God's ministers are wicked. What's going to happen? Well, the Lord let the Philistines come and attack Israel, and those young men were killed. And so, you know, they even brought out the Ark of the Covenant. They thought it'd be like a good luck charm. God says, hey, I don't need that. I don't need you people. You don't do what I say, you'll see what's going to happen. They died. And so that was a real example. You know, God let them lose. He let the Ark of the Covenant be taken by the pagans, by the Philistines. But he wasn't worried about it. They took it in front of their god Dagon, and God had the statue of that god fall down overnight, and it broke its hands off and stuff. God doesn't need us to protect him. He doesn't need human help to win a battle. He wants to work with humans. He's pleased when people cooperate with him. But if we won't, he doesn't need us. He's going to be glorified anyway. He gets what he says he's going to get done every time, even when we fail him. You know, that example of the Ark of the Covenant being taken by the Philistines, God plagued them. And he demonstrated his power to them and defeated their gods. And they had to bring back the Ark of the Covenant on their own. They brought it back. They were scared to death. They didn't want it anymore. And God allowed Israel to be taken captive by Assyria and Babylon. But then he punished both of those kingdoms and destroyed them. And he used his people that were held captive there as witnesses. And he accomplished a lot through that. God even predicted the exact length of the exile in Jeremiah 25:12. He said it would be 70 years, and that's exactly how long it was. And then he brought him back to the promised land, just as he said he would, so that the Messiah could come at the proper time. And by the way, the Magi who came and brought the gifts to the baby Jesus, they came from Persia because God's people had been in exile there. So, you know, God kind of got the knowledge of God's spread abroad through even the sin of Israel. God taught Israel through their sin, and he taught nations around him, and he continues to do that today. He's Lord of the nations, not just the little place called Israel. He's the Lord of history because it's his story. He always will punish those who disregard his word, whether they've been identified with his people or whether they're part of the so-called heathen nations. Nobody's immune or exempt. What God promises will be done. What he purposes will be accomplished. Nothing and no one can stop that or thwart that. If God's people live for him, they demonstrate his truth to the world. But if they rebel, if we rebel and we turn away, the consequences that'll come on us also demonstrate God's truth to the world. God always wins. And so there's one final message I want to share with you, and that's this, that our choices determine our destiny with God. Look at the majority is almost always wrong. Did you hear that? The majority is almost always wrong. Moses knew God had called him to liberate Israel, but most of his people didn't accept him at first. They rejected him. You know that? God's chosen one, they said, who are you, you know, to be a ruler over us? There were 12 spies that Moses sent into the promised land to spy it out before Israel came in. You know, 10 of those 12 spies didn't believe Israel could take that land. Hey, that's the majority. You know, Elijah was outnumbered 400-1 by the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. He was in the minority. Did you know the majority of the kings of Israel didn't do what was right in the eyes of the Lord? The northern kings all disobeyed, and only a few of the southern kings obeyed the Lord. The prophets constantly exhorted Israel and Judah to repent, but hardly anybody listened. See, in the end, the majority was so wrong, God had no choice but to turn them over to their enemies and to terrible judgments. Thousands were tortured, killed in battle, or by famine or pestilence. They were carried away into exile in chains. Everything seemed to end in failure and calamity. But throughout Israel's history, there were always some who did what was right in God's sight. There was always a remnant that chose to do the right thing. And because a few people did the right thing, that proves to us that everybody could have done the right thing. You know, God's purpose for Moses was accomplished. Israel was delivered from bondage, even though most of the people didn't like Moses. They constantly complained about it. Those two spies made it into the promised land when all the others died in the wilderness. As long as Joshua was alive, Israel did the right thing, and they took the promised land just as God said they would. Elijah was outnumbered by 400 prophets of Baal, but God gave him the victory, and God showed that he alone was God. Yes, most of the kings and most of the people of Israel were ungodly, but there were some shining exceptions too. David failed, but he also succeeded in a lot of ways, didn't he? Jehoshaphat overcame and, you know, overwhelming odds, right? And he was delivered from a million-man army. Hezekiah served the Lord, and God kept him from being swallowed up by the enemies of God when they surrounded his city, and it looked like they were doomed. God also healed him of a deadly disease and granted him long life. Josiah listened to the word of God, and he brought revival to his people. So there were always exceptions, right? The majority was almost always wrong, but the fact that there were always a few who did do what God said to do proves that all the rest could have. So even though the majority is almost always wrong, that's not an excuse to keep us from God. We have to choose, and our choices determine our destiny with God. 2 Chronicles 16:9 says, "The eyes of the Lord are always going throughout all the earth so that he can show himself strong on behalf of those whose hearts are committed to him." So that should be a lesson to us as we look at these historical books. Especially it's pertinent today because, you know, we used to be predominantly a Christian nation, but today our society is, you know, for the most part, wants nothing to do with God. They think it's a joke to consider God or live for God. Our whole country is sliding toward a dangerous precipice, if you want to know my opinion of things. The majority doesn't want the things of God. But you know what? God's purposes will still be accomplished. Some people think if America falls, God won't be able to do anything. Just like the Israelites thought, if Israel falls, God won't have a people. What will he do? There's no way for God's purposes to be accomplished. Oh, yeah, they'll still be accomplished. He would rather do it through us and with our cooperation. But if we won't cooperate, he's going to get it done. You know, there's a lot of discouraging things today, a lot of seeker-sensitive churches, people just preaching what folks want to hear and all that. And there's a lot of churches that are pretty much, you know, pretty carnal, pretty worldly. Many people are discouraged as they see things like the homosexual agenda taking over our society, the redefinition of marriage, the rewriting of the gospel, all these terrible things. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying just be fatalistic and accept all these things. No, we resist these things. We're against them. We're going to do all we can to reverse the trend. But I'm just telling you that at the same time, the message from the historical books is this. God will not be mocked. He always wins. Everything he says will come to pass. Most people may ignore him or rebel against him, and that's sad. But it'll be their loss, their destruction. Let you and me, let us be the ones who choose to live as God says to live, because we can be sure he'll take care of us, and we're going to be the last people standing, if you want to know the truth, no matter what the majority may do, even if the whole world is going in the wrong direction. As Joshua put it so eloquently so many thousands of years ago, "Choose you this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." So I'm going to call it quits right there for this message. The next teaching will deal with the wisdom and poetry of the Old Testament. Hope you'll tune in then.